We have three different recorders going tonight, so hopefully one of them will work.
Good chance it won't work.
Yeah. I'm gonna pass out the text that we're gonna be using tonight. Actually, you know what? I should probably keep one of those. You know what? So can we just move up? I mean, the entire front row. Here, how about this? If Moses won't come, if the mountain won't come to
Mohammed,
I'll just move up. Same thing. Sorry for those of you who didn't want to be in the front row. Better? Closer? Good. Okay. So this is the third part of the Gemara that I've been speaking about. This is now the third year. So, and this is the third and final year that we'll be learning this Gemara in particular. Next year, Bezrat Hashem will have the, we'll continue this tradition. I'll have to come up with a different Gemara to learn. So I think we've exhausted this one. Although who knows, it could be that if people don't remember, we could just start it up in like a triennial cycle of this particular Gemara. So I've chosen this Gemara for several reasons. One is that it has to do with the story of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who is the subject of Lag BaOmer, right? We celebrate his yard site, as it were, on Lag BaOmer. But really, that's only part of the reason that I enjoy learning and teaching this Gemara. It's just such a rich Gemara. As literature and as theology and as religion, it's just such a there are so many different levels going on in this Gemara. It really, as you've seen, 3 years, and every year, different aspects of the Gemara. Every year, a different aspect of the Gemara, and we're not exhausting it. And the final reason is because there are elements of this Gemara. Elements that I've come back to each of the years, that it tells the story of, the story begins with three Rabbanim, three Tana'im, who are trying to figure out not just how to engage a general culture, a broader culture, but in the wake of a great trauma, in this case the trauma of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. In the wake of that trauma, they're trying to figure out, okay, how do we move forward? How do we pick up the pieces after having gone through something like that and make life work again? Right? And in our own generations, we've seen a similar phenomenon, that after the Holocaust, the people that emerged from the Holocaust, as all four of my grandparents did, they were the ones, to whom fell the task of, okay, how do we carry forward? How do we keep our traditions? How do we keep our way of life relevant in a completely new surrounding, and having suffered from such an unspeakable tragedy? Really, all four of my grandparents, in their own way. I mean, tonight's year is Eloi Nishmatam, specifically. Three grandparents passed away during Sfirat HaOmer. My maternal grandfather Eric Levy passed away on Erev Shavuot in Tavshin Nunbet, 1992. My paternal grandfather passed away in Chol HaMoed Pesach of Tavshin Nundalid in 1994 in Chol HaMoed. My maternal grandmother passed away just 10 years ago. We just celebrated her 10th yard site. She passed away in right after Pesach in Tavshin Samach Aleph. So it's those three who are where this evening, whose memory this evening is dedicated. So let's take a look at the Gemara. Okay? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is emerging from the cave where he had spent 12 years of exile. Shama Pinchas ben Yair, Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair Chotne. His son-in-law Pinchas ben Yair heard. And he went out to meet him. Aile lebe banya. He took him to the bath. Havaka arech le lebisre. And he was massaging his flesh. Chazi da havabe pili begufe. He saw that he had, you know, wrinkles, clefts in his body, like some kind of sore from sitting in the cave for 12 years. Havaka bachi. So he started crying. Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair started crying. The kanatu dimote ne'u become a tzavakale. And his tears, the tears were falling, and they were causing pain to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Amalo, he said to him, Oili shiriticha b'kach. Woe to me that I've seen you like this, that I've seen you in such a state. Amalo, so Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai responded, Ashrecha shiriticha b'kach. Right? You should be happy that you're seeing me like this. Shilmali lo ri'itini b'kach. Had you not seen me like this, had you not seen me in this shriveled state, in this terrible physical state, I wouldn't have also been like this, right? I wouldn't have also had the advantages, right? What advantages? Originally, before he went into the cave, when Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai would ask a question, have a mafarik le Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair tresar peruki. Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair would offer 12 answers. Lesof, at the end, now after these 12 years in the cave, have a makshi Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair kushia. When Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair would ask a question, have a mafarik le Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai esen va'arba peruki. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai would offer 24 answers. Right, so. As opposed to earlier, where Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai was the one who needed his questions answered, now he's the one who can answer the question, and not only that, he doesn't just provide 12 answers, he provides 24 answers. So he's 288 times better than he was right, before he left, right? 12 times 24. Okay. Rabbi Shimon, right, during the 12 years that he was in the cave, he had lived ascetically, right? He had lived, as a parush, right? Somebody that was completely withdrawn from humanity. He neglected his body; he allowed it to wither. We learned this was already 2 years ago. We learned about how he buried himself in the sand up to his neck because he didn't wear any clothes. He had nothing to do, no contact with any human beings but his son for 12 years, living off of spring water and carobs. In order to reclaim a place in the social order, in order to come back to society, he has to pay closer attention to his physical well-being, to the physical in general. So what he has to do, in other words, he has to live up to the duality the duality of Shamor and Zachor. The last segment of this Gemara, right before this begins, right, it talks about how Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, when he emerged from his cave, he saw a Jew on Erev Shabbat, and he was holding two hadasim, one for Shamor and one for Zachor, and that put his mind at ease. Right? Because, we explained then, the idea of Shamor and Zachor is that Shabbat has a dual nature. It has a nature as one of the days of the week, and it influences the other days of the week, but it also has a separate existence that's kadosh, that's separate from the other days of the week, and these two aspects of Shabbat are symbolized by Shamor and Zachor. Right? And the paradox of Shabbat, like the paradox of human existence, are that you can exist both within and separate from the general community of nations, the rest of the world. We're part of the world and we're separate from the world at the same time, right? Or la goyim or mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh on one hand, and am levadad yishkon on the other, right? And there's no contradiction between them. It's not one or the other. It's not either or. Okay? So in order to rejoin society, in order to become part of society, once again, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai has to pay more attention to his physical well-being. He has to take care of himself. Now that's not to say that neglecting his body didn't serve its function. As he says, had you not seen me like this, you wouldn't see me like that. right? The price, right? He achieved a lot while he was in the cave, but it had a price. The price was that his physical well-being suffered. That's not a desirable end game. That's not something that once it's not something that he can't move past once he reemerges from society. But in order to achieve that, in order to get where he needed to be, right, he had to neglect his body for a certain number of years. He had to neglect the physical, the mundane, for a certain number of years. But it was worth the price, as Rav Shimon tells us. Now, it's interesting, if not ironic, that the place where Rabbi Shimon chooses to renew his focus upon the body and to renew his place within society is the bathhouse. At the beginning of this passage, there were three ways in which Rabbi Shimon criticized Rome. Right? He criticizes Roman baths, he criticizes Roman bridges, and he criticizes Roman markets. He says that the bridges are only there for them to collect our tolls, and the baths are only there so that we can pamper ourselves and we can overindulge. And the bridges are only, the markets are only there so that we can sit prostitutes down in the marketplaces. That's Rabbi Shimon's criticism of Rome. All these things that they're doing, all these things that everybody thinks are so great, it's all self-serving and it's all terrible, it's all, you know, it's all expressions of horrible values. So here, Rabbi Shimon, at the end, after 12 years, after having 13 years, after having criticized the Roman bath, he goes to the bath. Right? So he's no longer a reactionary in the sense that he can appreciate and participate in these elements of the prevailing culture and possibly even appropriate it for his own ends. Right? He's using the baths not for Rome's purpose, right, or not for the purposes that Rome set out for him, but for his own purposes. Rabbi Pinchas' tears, Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair sheds tears, and this causes pain to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Okay, now, earlier in this story, there was another episode that involved pain, and it was right before Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai went into the cave. The last stop he made before going into the cave was the Beit Midrash, right? And he was hiding out with his son in the Beit Midrash. And what happened? He got nervous. He got scared because he was afraid that his wife, who knew where he was and who was bringing him food every day, right, bread and water, she was bringing him bread and water every day. Rabbi Shimon says, you know what? I'm afraid that the Romans are going to capture her and torture her, right? And she's going to give us up because, you know, nashim datan kalot. Right, that's what the Gemara actually says. Right, it says, yeah, you know, like, that's something that women do. Like, they break under torture. Right, we men, we wouldn't break under torture. Like, every man is Jack Bauer. I think I used that one 2 years ago, but it never gets old. People crack under torture, right? But the point was. The point is that here Rabbi Shimon is, rather than, you know, earlier where any kind of weakness, any kind of, you know, anything that causes pain that's going to cause people to break under torture, Rabbi Shimon, he's dismissing it, right? And now he's sympathizing with it. It's not Rabbi Shimon's own sores that cause him pain. What causes him pain, right, are the tears of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair is crying when he sees Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's state. And that's what causes Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai pain. Right? So he's learning how to be sensitive to the pain of others, right? Which is something that was absent before he went into the cave. And it gets better because later on in the Gemara, we're going to see a few lines later when he does something to repair society, when he creates. Right, when he figures out a way that the Kohanim could travel through the graveyard, right? It says that. The fact that they had to go around the graveyard was causing the Kohanim pain. Right? So part of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's transformation, part of the way that part of what enables him to re-enter society, to re-engage society, is his sensitivity to the plight of other people, is his sensitivity to the pain of other people. Right? That he can hear and he can understand what's causing the people pain. That's what allows him to re-emerge, and that's what allows him to re-engage. There's another element of the paradox of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. He says, the last line, lo matzata bi'kach, right? You would not have found me like this, right? And had I not been like this, right? Had I not had the sores, you wouldn't have found me the way that I am now, that I can answer your questions in 24 ways. We talk in modern Hebrew about being nimtza, about being present, about being here, right? And it's not just modern Hebrew, it's already back to medieval Hebrew, possibly earlier, being nimtza. He says, lo matzata bikach, right? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is saying that he's here, he's present, right? It's not only that, you know, he hasn't been present for the last 12, 13 years, right? Even before that, he wasn't really present. He was past. He was in the past. And it's more than that. It's having been in the cave for 12 or 13 years is what allows him to come back into the present. Had I not been away for 12 years, had I not paid the price with these sores on my body, right, I would not have been able to reemerge at all. I wouldn't have been able to move back into the present. The reason, the secret of Rabbi Shimon's ability to act and be creative and be productive within Roman culture is the fact that he's no longer threatened by it. I can live in the present now. I can live in the here and now. I don't have to live within Roman society, Roman culture under protest, living in some kind of idealized form of a Jewish past. He can finally have a present. He has the confidence, right? He has the self-confidence, the self-assuredness to plot the Torah's course through a new and a different kind of experience and circumstance. And this is what it means, this Talmudic virtue, this newfound Talmudic virtuosity. This 288-fold advance in his Talmudic acumen. It's not just that he can answer questions better now. Now I know all the answers. Now I know more solutions to a particular problem. The number 12, as we saw, we see it earlier in the Gemara, the number 12, right, it denotes a completion of a cycle, something full. Right? Saying that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's knowledge of Torah, when he emerges from the cave, is something that's full, it's something that's whole, it's something that's complete. When you have complete knowledge of something, well, you don't know something just as a set of rules or a set of principles that apply to an infinite number of circumstances. When your knowledge of it is whole and intuitive, right, the answers are something that come naturally. The answers are something, you know, it's not even an effort to come up with an answer. The best poskim, when you ask them a question, they know the answer, and then afterwards they find a justification for the answer. Right? They have it. It's so ingrained within them. It's so much a part of their vision of the world, right, that they know what the Torah would say. They know what the Torah should say. If you ask them, okay, how do you get to that conclusion? They'll have to go back and reconstruct it. But that's the second step. Right? The first step is they know what the answer is supposed to be. Right? So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's knowledge of Torah emerging from the cave is such that his knowledge is much more whole, right? And as such, he's able to apply it to a variety of circumstances that he wasn't able to apply it to before, because it's not just a question of looking at what he received, it's not just a question of what does the tradition say, it's a question of it's been digested to such a great degree, it's a part of him to such a great degree, that he's overflowing now with, you know, in this situation, this is how you do it, and in this new situation, and in all these new situations, and in all these different circumstances, right, and in all of these different cases of need, and in all of these different kinds of, you know, new issues that are coming up, he knows exactly what the answer should be. And that's the quality of the Torah knowledge. It's not just a question of quantitative. He knew 288 times more Torah. There's a qualitative edge that he has now, having emerged from the cave. Amar, so he says, Ho'il v'itrachesh nisa. since a miracle happened, Egel Itkin Milta. I will go and I will repair something. Dichtiv, it says, Vayavo Yaakov Shalem. Yaakov came complete, whole, to the city of Shechem. V'amar Rav, Rav said about this, Shalem b'gufo, Shalem b'mamono, Shalem b'torato. He was complete and whole on three different levels, physically, financially, and religiously in Torah. V'yichan et pnei ha'ir, and he graced, or, and he encamped facing the city, and they learn it as V'yichan et pnei ha'ir, that he graced the face of the city. Amar Rav, matbea tikin lahem, he minted a coin. Shmuel Amar, shvakin tikin lahem, he established markets. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, mechatzaot tikin lahem, he established bathhouses. All three things that he had complained about. Okay? So, now that we've established that Rabbi Shimon has returned to a point where he values temporal life, where it's not only about immersing in Torah, that there is value, right, that he has accepted temporal life, which he rejected the first time he comes out of the cave, and he saw somebody planting and plowing, and he burns them up. Like, people are neglecting eternal life to engage in temporal life. Now he's engaging in temporal life. So the next thing that he does is, I want to contribute. I want to contribute to the world. I want to fix something. I want to prepare something. I want to do tikkun olam. Right? That's how they say it in America. That's English for... Yeah. So first of all, he sees it as a midah keneged midah, as a quid pro quo. Since a miracle happened, I will go and I will repair something. What was the miracle that had happened? There's only one thing that it says that it happened to him, where it actually says that it was a nace, and that's the fact that God sustained him for those 12 years in the cave. Right? That a miracle happened, and the carob tree grew, and the spring started flowing, and that enabled him to... So the miracle that he underwent is God's sustenance. God provided for him. And he's saying, midah keneged midah, God provided for me. I'm going to do something for God's creatures. I'm going to provide for God's creatures. So it's, in a sense, it's a chesed that contains within it an imitatio Dei, a halicha b'drachav. God graced me, right, did a chesed for me by sustaining me. I'm going to do a chesed for God's creatures. Right, so it's a completely different relationship with the world that he has now. And then the Gemara interjects this seemingly unrelated story about Yaakov arriving in the city of Shechem. But Yaakov's arrival in the city of Shechem is not unrelated at all. This is the second time that the Gemara superimposes a different dimension, a mythic dimension, onto the narrative. Right, we saw it earlier with the story of Eliyahu HaNavi, that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's story closely parallels the story of Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu HaNavi's flight away from society, away from a prevailing society that he just couldn't tolerate anymore, right? And he's down on the people, and he's down on the kingdom, right? And he runs away, and he encounters God in a cave, and then he comes back, but he doesn't really reintegrate. Whereas Shimon Bar Yochai, he runs away, he's persecuted, just like Eliyahu was. The king threatens him, just like Eliyahu was threatened. Right? And the difference is that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is able to reintegrate into society. Right? And Eliyahu HaNavi, we saw that he appears to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai at the exact place where, at the place where he could go either way. Eliyahu's failure happened in the cave. Eliyahu, you know, he was in the cave, he was given the chance. We're not going to go through that whole parak in Malachim. He was given the chance to try to understand and to try to sympathize with the people. He failed at it. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is given that same chance, and he ultimately succeeds. Right, they were each actually both given two chances. Here, we see the story of, again, the parallels between the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and the story of Yaakov Avinu. For example, Yaakov ran away, ran into exile, into hiding from his brother Esav. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai runs away, fearing death, from Rome, who is a descendant of Esav, and who in throughout rabbinic literature represents Rome. After spending many years in exile, Yaakov returns to his homeland, and he finds a way to make peace with his brother. Right, that Yaakov, at the beginning of Parashat Vayishlach, right, he finds a way to make peace with Esav. Are they buddy buddies? No, it wasn't a great relationship, right? But they found a way to live together. They found a way to coexist. And it was immediately after his encounter with Esav and his encounter with Esav's malach that Yavo Yaakov Shalem Ir Shechem. Now Yaakov came to the city of Shechem, and he was Shalem, right? He was unscathed. So here you have Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai at the exact same moment, right? He's at the exact same point in his own story, right? His arrival at the bathhouse, or his coming out of the bathhouse, corresponds precisely to Yaakov's arrival in Shechem, right? He had his fight with Rome, he ran away from Rome, and then he came back and made his peace. Right? So he's at that same moment that Yaakov was at when Yaakov arrived in the city of Shechem. So Rav speaks of three different kinds of wholeness, of completion. The physical, the financial, and in Torah. Right? Rav Kook, typically, understands that there are three aspects of the same overarching wholeness, right? That you can't have one without the other. Right, and this is very much part of Rav Kook's worldview, that you have to have that one type of wholeness, right? If you're whole in one aspect, right, and you neglect other aspects, you're not really whole in that one aspect. That you can only be perfect in one aspect if it's counterbalanced by your wholesomeness in other aspects. And so it's a very Rav Kookian idea, the fact that you've Shalem in all three of these areas. You can't relate to Torah unless you're whole financially. Don't we know that? And vice versa. Right, that was actually at my grandmother's yard site a few weeks ago. We had a family get together, and like we all, you know, each one of us learned a Mishnah that reminded us in some way of my grandmother, and the Mishnah that I don't remember if I chose it or my wife chose it, but like it emerged out of our discussion together, was Imein Kemach Ein Torah, Imein Torah Ein Kemach, right? That the financial well-being and religious spiritual well-being in Torah, right, are two sides of the same coin. That you can't really have one without the other. So this is also part of Rabbi Shimon's learning curve. Right, Rabbi Shimon's attitude had been, I'm going to neglect everything else in the world and I'm only going to learn Torah. And that's actually Rabbi Shimon's position in the Gemara and Brachot, right, which some say is the kernel, right, from which this entire story emerges. Rabbi Shimon is the one who says, I neglect everything and I only learn Torah. Right? And the Gemara comments on that. There are many people that tried to do what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai did and didn't succeed. Right, that it's considered too much of an elitist position, that it can't be something it's not something that's sustainable. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, at the beginning of the story, was of that attitude, and now he's acquired a different, a more shalem approach, right, that he synthesizes instead of compartmentalizing, right, that Torah to the exclusion of, the Torah with the assistance of. So Yaakov goes and he builds the institutions that are necessary for the function of society. Baths and markets and coins. Right? That's what Yaakov does. And these are the same three elements, as you pointed out, that Shimon Bar Yochai criticized at the beginning of the story. Right? That here the money takes the place of the bridges. Right? Because the bridges, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's critique of the bridges was they only set them up in order to collect tolls. Right, so you have all three elements are covered. But now, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, instead of seeking to destroy them, instead of seeing them as evil, he wants to enhance them. He wants to develop the potential to participate in, right, in broader society. So he asks, Amar, Ika milta de bailut kuni, is there something that needs to be repaired? Amule, they said to him, Ika duchta de itbe safek tuma, there's a place that has a safek tuma. The itlihu tsar le kohanim la akufi. And it's painful, right, it's troublesome for the kohanim to go all the way around. Amar, so he said, Ika inish de yada de itzazek hachatara, is there anybody knows that there was a chazakah, that we know, that we remember that there was any kind of tahara here? Amar le hahu saba. And an old man said to him, "Tan kitzeitz ben zakai tor mesei truma." Here, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who was a Kohen, he harvested tormesin, right? Tormesin is lupines. What did I say? Okay. That were truma, right? So if he was going in there, and if it was truma, then it couldn't have been tameh because truma was being handled there. So avad hiu nami hachi. So he did the same thing, and he cut down the lupines. Kolhecha dahava kashi, wherever the ground was hard, tahare. He said that it was pure. Kolhecha dahava rafi, and wherever the ground was soft, sine. He marked it off. He delimited it so that the kohanim wouldn't walk there. If the three elements that of society that Rabbi Shimon originally criticized were bridges, baths, and markets, the one that he chooses to fix here is the bridge. What's a bridge? A bridge is essentially a shortcut. You don't want to have to go all the way around, so you have a bridge that goes over. And so that's essentially what's going on here. The Kohanim, he didn't want the Kohanim to have to go all the way around. So instead they went over. And the truth of the matter is that of all the things you can do to repair society, this seems like the most trivial. Okay, so you walk an extra 5 minutes, right? It's just a matter of convenience, right? It's not something that's essential. It's something that it would be nice. But the point is that even that is a contribution. Even something that you might think that the only way to contribute to society, oh, I'm going to be a doctor, I'm going to save man. No, contributions to society come in many different ways and in many different shapes and forms. Right? Creating a shortcut for the Kohanim, right, is another way to contribute to society. But there's something here that's specifically rabbinic. Right? There's something here that the way that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai contributes to society, does he build a bridge? No, he doesn't build a bridge. He doesn't build anything. He marks some graves. Right? So he's contributing halachically. Right? And this essentially is the role of the rabbi. Right? I often think about this when I consider the issue of Eruvin. Right? What's an Eruv? Are you building something? It's a wire. It's imaginary. Right? It's not imaginary, but it's no more or less real than international borders and international boundaries, which wars are fought over. So, you know, if it's not real, furthermore, if the line of the Eruv is imaginary, how do you explain that the house on this side of the Eruv boundary costs twice as much as the house on the other side? It's real. It's very, very real. Right? It's not physical, but it's real. So you have this is Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's contribution, and this is the contribution of a Talmud Chacham, of a Rav, of a Gadol, of a Posek. That's the contribution that he makes to society. It's not that he's going to build a bigger building, or he's going to build a mall, or a supermarket, or he's not going to build an actual physical bridge, and he's not going to mint an actual coin. But what he might do is allow a Jew the leeway to become a banker, figure out a way that he could be a banker while somehow obviating the issues of Ribit, figure out a way that women can leave their homes on Shabbat, not because it's absolutely essential, but because it's convenient and it makes Shabbos more meaningful, Right? So he's going to build an A-roof. He's going to figure out a way around Rebeet. He's going to design a Prusable. It's not that he's saying, these are not shortcuts in the sense that, right, he's, but I'm not even going to get into the polemic of, is a Prusable, is it innovation, or is it something that was already there? It's sort of beside the point. I shouldn't have even brought it up. The point is that the role of the Rav, the role of the Posek, the role that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai arrogates for himself here is, I'm going to be constructive halachically. I'm going to use halacha, I'm going to use my halachic virtuosity that I spent 13 years in the cave perfecting, right? I'm going to bring that to bear on the very real issues that are facing very real people, the Kohanim that can't walk around the cemetery, right? And I'm going to use my halachic prowess to make their lives easier, to make their lives better, to allow them to engage the world in a more comfortable way. It doesn't have to be some great idea. It makes it more comfortable for them, so that they don't have to spend the extra time, so they don't have to spend an extra few dollars. It's okay, I'll come up with the kula. There's something much deeper going on here too. Okay, this is why I gave the shiur the title of A Path Through the Graveyard. In addition to being a very real halachic, a real and present halachic issue, it's also a symbol, right? Charting a path through the graveyard can signify something much more important. A generation that experiences a severe crisis, severe tragedy, a rupture with the past, right, where on the other side of the crisis, you perceive yourself as being part of a new era. Right, that's the definition of a rupture. A rupture is a crisis that's so profound that you feel like there's this unbridgeable gap between where you stand after the crisis and the era that existed before the crisis. Right? And the Holocaust was obviously such a rupture. We don't relate to a continuous Jewish path. Right? There's a dividing line of the Holocaust, and there was the world before the Holocaust, and there was the world after the Holocaust, and they're not the same world. And we who weren't from that world, we don't relate to it. We can't understand it. It's a past. It's stuck in the past. There were people that experienced it. They can relate to that past. But our world is such a completely different world. Right? That's the definition of a rupture. There's a break, right? The Hebrew word for a crisis is a shever, right? There's a break. There's a discontinuity. So there are different tendencies in that generation that grows up after the rupture, after the crisis. One of those tendencies is to preserve everything that's possible to preserve, without attempting to distinguish between those parts of the past that are essential to my current identity and those parts of the past which are accidental, right, that were the function of a particular time and place and have no more relevance. What we do instead is we sanctify the entire past. The entire past is now kadosh. Of course, there are some parts of the past that have to be updated and brought into the present and nourished, and there are parts of the past that are dead weight and should be jettisoned. Right? But this impulse, and it's an understandable impulse, right, is to treat the entire past essentially as an unmarked graveyard. There are parts where there's death, there's parts where we can walk through, but we're not going to try to differentiate what are the parts that are dead and what are the parts that are living. We just treat it all as a safek. We treated all, everything in the past might have been important. We no longer have the tools to determine what was important and what wasn't, what was essential and what was peripheral. We don't have those tools anymore. Right? We're an orphan generation. Right? We don't have the tools to differentiate the living matter from the dead weight. So we treat the whole thing as a safek, as possibly death. And this creates two really, really major risks. One risk that happens when we sanctify the entire past is that we allow for no innovation, no rethinking of the way things were, right? And that stunts our ability, right? It means we have to ignore the present. We have to remain, as it were, in the past. The second great risk, right, is that we do the same thing. We relegate the past to the past, but instead of living in the past, we live in the present. Right? We just jettison the whole thing and think it's irrelevant. We throw out the baby with the bathwater. The two great risks of not differentiating between past and present, not differentiating between living and dead, is that we ignore the whole thing or that we stay within the past. Right? We keep the past in the past and we stay in the past, or we keep the past in the past and we move on to a present completely disconnected from that past. It requires somebody like a Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who at this point in the story, right, has managed to remain rooted in the past, right, but is also able to engage the present, right? So it's his job, it's his task to chart a course, right, a path, a halakha, right, a walking, a way of going through the graveyard, right? And that's essentially what he does, right? He's by charting a path through the graveyard, it's a matter of local convenience, but it's also a symbol of the entire project of what he's trying to do. For the Kohanim to walk through, who are the Kohanim, if not the entire Jewish people? Mamlechet Kohanim. That if the Jewish people have a mission to the world, if a Kohen is somebody that stands between God and man, right, serving both God and man, bringing God's message to man, whether we're talking about a Jewish Kohen who stands between God and the Jewish people, or the Jewish people as a whole who stand between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the rest of the world, right, the mission to be a Mamlechet Kohanim relies on our ability to forge a path through the graveyard, to pick up the shattered pieces after a trauma, to be able to discern the living organism from dead weight, and to constantly be able to carry forward. So how does he accomplish this? The first thing that he turns to is memory. Is the past really wholly shrouded in fog? Is it really completely indiscernible, undistinguishable, inaccessible? Or is it just that we have a tendency, standing on the other side of the crisis, to relate to it that way? So what Rabbi Shimon does is he consults the remnants of the previous generation, and he finds out who still remembers what life was like, who can attest, who can help me recover what's living and what's dead. And he finds a link back to the generation of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was the last person that had to deal with it, who Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was also charged with the task of picking up the pieces after a crisis, after Churban Bayit Sheni. He has to rebuild, and he moves to Yavne, and he begins the process of rebuilding there. So he becomes the role model for Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's task. And he cuts down lupines in the cemetery, tormusin. You can see them. We actually have Chol Hamoed Pesach. I saw some tormusin, Givata tormusin, and Emek Ha'ela. They come in a pod like peas, but apparently the way that you cook a lupine is that it's very bitter if you eat it raw, and very bitter, and you have to boil it multiple times. Right, you boil it and you peel off a layer, and you boil it and then you peel off more layers, and only the very center is sweet. That's what Rav Kook says about it. But I think that can also symbolize what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is trying to do. Right, that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is he's cooking, he's digesting, he's removing the external peripheral elements, right, in order to distinguish it from the living, the edible kernel within. Right? That's the process that he engages in the graveyard, right? That he engages in a process of separating the wheat from the chaff, separating the grain from the chaff. Right? We need to know what's essential and what can or must be jettisoned. The old man says, Tiyah Rabbi Ben Yochai Beit HaKvarot. Bar Yochai has purified a graveyard. Amar Le, he said to him, had you not been with us, or if you had been there and you hadn't voted, Yafa Tomer, I could accept what you're saying. Achshav Shahayita Imanu V'Nimneita Imanu, now you were there, and you voted Yomru, they'll say Zonot Mufarkasot Zuadzu. Harlots help make each other up, right? They help beautify each other. Talmidei Chachamim look closer. Shouldn't rabbis do that too? Right? So here you have somebody, this old man who had just testified to what he saw in his youth. He turns on Rabbi Shimon. He no longer trusts himself. Right? He was afraid to take this unpopular stand. Apparently, it came down to a vote. It wasn't so clear that Rabbi Shimon's position that you could be mitaher this graveyard would be accepted. And this person, this old man, he takes the easy way out. Right? I don't want to move off the status quo. The status quo, it might not be ideal. In fact, it's much less than ideal. I'd rather relate to it all as a cemetery. I don't want to move forward. Right? So this old man is not like the old man that Rabbi Shimon encountered before, the old man who was running on Erev Shabbat. The other old man was running, was moving vigorously forward. Ancient, but fresh. This old man suffers from paralysis, a religious paralysis. He's an impediment to progress. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and you have the attitudes are completely different. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is using his halachic knowledge in order to contribute something to society, in order to repair society. This person is using his almost a halachic hypochondria, right, a halachic paralysis to impede the improvement of society. So Rabbi Shimon is almost the diametric opposite of what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai stood for at this point. In fact, you could make the case that this old man was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai himself in his prior incarnation. Right? This is the old Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, he looks at him, and the man dies. Yavda Enei V'Nach Nafshei. He looked at him and he died. You want to relate to the whole past as a cemetery? You want to see everything as a cemetery? Then that cemetery is where you belong. Right? He's saying to him, you're relegating yourself to the past. Right? You don't belong anywhere but the past, if that's the attitude that you're going to take. So he's killing him? He's killing him. Whether or not he dies, he's killing him. If he doesn't die, he's basically saying to him, you're making yourself irrelevant. Right? If you're not applying the halacha that you know, deep down you know it. You gave testimony that Bar Yochai cut down lupines here. Right? And if you're not... Thank you. That Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai cut down lupines here, you're giving testimony to that effect. If you can't stand by that, if you don't have the courage to stand by it and to allow that to improve life here in the present, then you're stuck in the past. You're relegated to the past. You're irrelevant. You looked at him, and the man died. He stayed in the cemetery. Nafak Lashuka. He went out to the market. So again, you had Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, when he rejoined society, first he goes to the bathhouse, then he builds a bridge through the cemetery, and now he goes to the market, all three places that he had criticized before. And he even refers to Zonot, which was part of his critique earlier, part of his critique of the bridges was Lahoshiv Bahem Zonot. He even makes reference to them, and he says that, you know what, Talmidei Chachamim might even have something to learn from them. The Talmidei Chachamim might have something to learn that just as they understand that the perception, everybody else's perception of them, right, that there might be internal competition between them, right, but that internal competition can't extend outwards, that we have a vested interest in helping each other because our class as a whole has to have a certain amount of respect if we're to remain relevant. The rabbis look holshikin. That the rabbis, if their bickering is going to drag down the rabbinate, right? Of course there's machloket, of course there's disagreement, and of course there's jealousy and all kinds of, you know, bad blood between rabbis. But if we don't help each other present ourselves, if we constantly undermine each other publicly, then what chance do we have of earning any kind of respect? And then he goes out to the market and he sees Yehuda ben Giri. Amar, adayin yesh but lazeba ulam? This guy's still around? Natan bo einav asahu galshal atzamot. He looked at him and he became a pile of bones. We'll conclude with this, but I think that this last line of Yehuda ben Gerim serves a very, very important function. There's a tendency to say that at the end of the story, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai ends up agreeing with Rabbi Yehuda bar Ilai. At the beginning of the story, Rabbi Yehuda bar Ilai is the one that says, "How great are the Romans?" And Rabbi Yossi was silent, and Rabbi Shimon was like, "No, the Romans are terrible." So now at the end of the story, we can say, oh, Rabbi Shimon agrees with Rabbi Yehuda bar Ilai, and he also thinks that the Romans are great. But no, Yehuda ben Gerim at the beginning of the story was the one who reported what each rabbi said to the Romans, and Rabbi Yehuda bar Ilai was made the chief spokesman, and Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai was condemned to death. And so now when he comes back, he doesn't say, oh, Yehuda ben Gerim, you might expect him to say, you know what, you were right the whole time. You know what, I was too antagonistic, I was too down on Rome. You know what? These bathhouses, they are pretty good. Right? But he doesn't do that. He says, this guy's still around? And he looks at him, and he becomes a pile of bones. Now, the personality of Yehuda ben Gerim, the way that we described it, was that Yehuda ben Gerim is the child of that generation that grows up after the rupture. Right? He's Yehuda. He's a Jew. Quintessential Jewish name. What could be more of a Jewish name than Judah? But he's ben Gerim. Right? He doesn't have a past. He's not rooted in any kind of past. He's the son of Gerim. He's the son of proselytes. He's the son of newcomers. Right? He doesn't have any kind of past to draw on. So Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai at the beginning of the story, who was all past, no present, no future, he's the one that is he and Yehuda ben Gerim are completely at odds. Now, at the end of the story, Yehuda ben Gerim is still in that situation. He still doesn't have a past. But Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai takes a different attitude toward him. And Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, I think this shows that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, if we started off with three positions of Rabbi Yehuda bar Ilai, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, we end up with four. There's Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai A, and there's Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai B. Rabbi Shimon does not just merely become an advocate of accommodation, right, or of integration. At the beginning, he was a resistor, right, if you want to use words, right. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai was resisted the prevailing culture. Rabbi Yehuda bar Ilai was the accommodationist. I'm sorry, was the integrationist. He wanted to integrate it. Rabbi Yossi wanted to come up to some kind of modus vivendi, maintaining silence, the typical gullus Jew attitude of, you know, you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone, right? Coexistence or tolerance. I don't know what the word is to describe this new attitude of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. I don't know if there is a word, right? It's a full engagement without any kind of concession. It's a full engagement without any kind of... It doesn't really want to integrate. It doesn't try to integrate, right? But it wants to fully engage. I won't use a word. What I will do instead is give examples. We recently celebrated the 25th anniversary of Rav Moshe Feinstein's yard site. Rav Moshe Feinstein's 25th yard site. Rav Moshe Feinstein engaged the reality of America to a degree that was really unmatched amongst the poskim of that generation. You know, the greatest American posek, bar none. And it wasn't because he spoke the American language, and it wasn't because, right, he engaged America, not because he identified with America ideologically, and not because he had a certain degree of sophistication that allowed him to, and not because he was able to use highfalutin language that Americans love. That wasn't his secret. That wasn't what it was about. He fully engaged it, remaining fully rooted within his world. In fact, trying to recreate his world, or recreate the values, the traditions, the traditional way of life within that new situation. In the next couple of weeks, there's going to be a book coming out, and I was privileged to have translated it, a biography of Rav Yehuda Amital. But if Yehuda Amital became who he was, the man had a high school education and no more. I think he spent 4 years of his entire life. He always used to contrast himself with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has a PhD from Harvard. He's like, yeah, my education went through eighth grade. The reason that he was able to engage, able to bring his message to so many people, and you know, to have his message resonate with so many people, and to be beloved by so many people, to really an unprecedented spectrum of Israeli society, right, is because he was able to engage it on his own terms, because he could come feel comfortable, rooted in his own, you know, memory of a certain way of life, and he was able to, without any apologetics, without any attempt to, you know, without any attempt to apologize for it, or to polemicize, just be what he, the way he thought a Jew should be, in his time and in his place. Right? So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is the paragon of that type of personality. At the end of the story, he comes back. He just wants to be. Right? He's going to bring his knowledge, his experience, his erudition to bear, because that's who he is. That's what he is. Whatever the situation is, he will find a way to engage it. And Rav Moshe Feinstein did that with America. Whatever the issue was, whatever the new issue was, he found a way. He engaged it, not because he had an agenda, a modernizing agenda, or because he really wanted to update and to upgrade it. He thought this is what had to be. Right? He was whole enough, he was shalem enough in his, you know, in a sense, he was able to come out through the end, through the other side of that rupture, of that crisis, whole, and he was able to project that wholeness on the world around him, even though it was a very, very different world. Another example, I think I mentioned him last year also, is Rav Yitzchak Ber Bamberger. And he lived in Germany at a time where there were major transformations going on. Right? And these transformations, they were shaking German society and German Jewish society to the core. You had reform, and you had Haskalah, and there were attitudes within Orthodoxy to be retrenchant. We had Shamson Rafal Hirsch wanted to secede, right, and wanted to create an Orthodoxy that withdrew from the rest of society, even while engaging with the rest of Jewish society, even while appreciating society. And Rav Seligman Ber Bamberger, right, he was taking an attitude of, and he was the dmut of a traditional Rav to a greater degree than Rav Shamson Rafal Hirsch was. He didn't write in this great flowery German, and he wasn't visiting operas like Rav Shamson Rafal Hirsch was, right? He was a postie, right? And he lived in a small town in southern Germany called Würzburg, but from that vantage point, he was able to construct a different way of life, right, that didn't engage the new realities in the same way that Rav Shamson Rafal Hirsch did, and the way that Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer did. And in certain ways, it was more wholesome. It wasn't an orthodoxy. He didn't create an orthodoxy that had to, you know, that had to apologize, or that saw itself as constantly being on the run. I mentioned Rav Bamberger because that was where he founded the institution where my maternal grandfather got his training, the teacher's training seminary in Würzburg, and I mentioned Rav Amital because he comes from the same milieu, the same area of the world, of Transylvania as my paternal grandparents. That all four of my grandparents, they had that same quality, right? That they emerged on the other side of the Holocaust, right? With a certain wholesomeness, a wholesomeness of character, with a wholesomeness of Yiddishkeit, where they didn't have to apologize for it, that they didn't have to, they never became terrible, they weren't, engaging America as Americans. They never stopped being immigrants, they never stopped being Europeans, but they had a wholesomeness to them. A tmimut, a shleimut, in their yahadut, that they knew what they had to do. Right? They knew that this is the way that we behave. This is the way that, you know, this is the way that we're supposed to be a Jew. Right? And if we're in America now, this is the way that we're supposed to be a Jew in America, firmly rooted in their past, but able to project that in the present and to give it over to a future generation. And so what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai ultimately says to this Yehuda ben Gerim, says, you still don't get it. A rootless Judaism can't have a future. A rootless Judaism, right, it lacks any kind of vigor. It lacks any kind of, it's a shell, or better, it's a skeleton, right? You might have all the rules, you might have the structure of Jewish life, but it's inanimate, right? Unless you're rooted in a past, unless you're coming from a place where you see how it interacts over the span of different generations and in different worlds, and you appreciate how it's supposed to work, how it's supposed to address different cultures and different realities, there's no way for you to move forward in it. So Yehuda ben Gerim, right, the fact that you're rootless, right, means that you don't have any way to carry it forward. Right? You don't have any way, right, it's almost like the critique of, like, your Judaism, you're evaluating your Judaism based on your Yahadut, based on these external standards, based on the values and the beliefs of society at large. And you're stripping Judaism down to what you think, right, you know, you're a Roman of Mosaic persuasion. Right? You're stripping yourself down, right, you're identifying Judaism with those parts of prevailing culture that you can make work with your Judaism, right? You're not coming from a vantage point where you're shalem. And as a result, his critique of him is, you're a skeleton, you're bones without flesh, without meat, without blood, without life, right? You don't have any way of carrying it forward. You don't have any way of making it vigorous, right? And it's at that point that he ends, that Rabbi Shimon says, even though he's willing to engage the present, Rabbi Shimon never... He never relegates it to mere present. He always has his eye on the past, and he always has his eye on the future, and it's that, you know, he lives in the present, right? But he lives in the present with that eye on the past, with that eye on the future, and that's what enables him to reemerge into society and to make a contribution.